this hour together is a period of time for questions and answers. With the question and answer period, may touch upon a broad range of themes. So, from the meditations, from the small groups, from what you've listened to in the talks, from areas and aspects of life which are important for you, which are worthy of some further reflection and exploration. So, in this hour, do feel free to ask any question. You can, if you wish, direct the same question to the two of us or to one of us, and we'll endeavour to respond. If the question's a little unclear or unsure, we might just ask for a little expansion on the question in order to get a clearer picture about what you are asking about. So, anyone has anything at all that you'd like to ask AJ or myself or both of us, please feel free to. Yes, please, yes.
Both
of us? Fine. In fact, just to give your name before you ask the question.
My name is Gal.
Gal, yes.
What can you say about the fear from powerfulness? We talk about fear. A lot of time we act fear as fear from losing, but there is fear from success.
Yes.
Fear to achieve.
So the question directed to both of us is around fear, and the fear of success or the fear of power, did you say?
Yeah.
Or fear of achievement. AJ, any response?
You start.
All right, I'll start. Dharma perspective, which sometimes is different from the ordinary one, in fact quite regularly so. So in Dharma, in all situations, fear is regarded as an unnecessary, inappropriate, unwise, unskillful, useless response to situations. This is fear. In the Dharma, there's not a single good word to be said for it, etc. And fear is that which blocks us. Fear holds us back. Fear is a contraction which inhibits wise action or wise non-action. And as you point out, that, shall we say, in the so-called choices of life, in which there is some imagination involved in every choice of what the result would be, because all choices are about concerns with results, there can be for some, in making a choice and making a movement, fear arising. And some people fear success in case it all goes wrong. Some people fear to take risks. And that fear inhibits the movement. So the questioning of fear is a deeply important one. It's an exploration for the liberation into a fearlessness. And sometimes people will say in report, oh, we need fear because it stops us from doing stupid things. And the incident that I can recall of the much beloved Krishnamurti, who died some years ago, speaking in a hall in a theatre in Holland, and somebody from the upper balcony at the end of the lecture, when he from giving the questions, the offering question, said to him, shouted to him, Krishnamurti, Krishnaji, we need fear. Human beings require fear. It's fear which stops me from jumping off this balcony and hurting myself and hurting others. And Krishnamurti, in his inestimable style, shouted back up there, sir! Anybody who's listened to Krishnamurti, I had lunch with him a couple of times. It's the same voice even when you have lunch. He said, sir, it's not fear which stops you from jumping off the balcony. It's intelligence. We just need to be clear. All right. Listen.
Yeah, you know, I think I totally agree, you know, but like if you have something like some unclarity, maybe, you know, asking like something more, then maybe I can say something more, because it feels to me, you know, this is appropriate answer so far. But some, you know, some other thing, you know.
I think about it, uh-huh. Not now,
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Anyone have any questions?
Essence of the teachings in one or two sentences or 1-2 minutes, what would you say?
Directed to both or one?
To both. No, you can't.
You want me to go first?
Yeah.
So the question is, if you were to give the essence of the teachings in 1 or 2 sentences, what would those 1 or 2 sentences be? What immediately comes to mind is the essence of the teachings is liberation from all clinging without exception. The teachings are a liberation from any kind of clinging to anything whatsoever. And for me, the voice, the teachings, the practices are all pointing to that. To me, that's the hub, the kernel, the essence running all the way through, from the root to the leaves. You take the human being as the tree here.
So I will say, keep on. You know, don't stop, keep on. That will be the essence of the teaching. Okay. Just keep on.
Any more to add?
You know, don't get bored, you know.
Okay. Yes, anyone, any questions you'd like to ask this evening? Yes, yes,
ma'am. Question for the people who have asked. Most people in the hall that's already, so I might as well.
All right, well, fair enough.
The difference in your teaching styles is about as different as the color of your skin.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed that your hair is almost just as good. I think the point is that it was maybe the color of your hair.
Nice, good question.
Yeah.
AJ.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you know, I think in my case, like, you know, there will be, say, like historical, you know, reference of dharma. Like, and that is like collected in forms of books. And there is like a language in that. So my like inefficiency is because I haven't contacted that, you know. I only contact like the feeling of dharma. And then I have to create a language, probably, you know, which you don't understand, you know, kind of. And this is why you don't understand. So, you know, this is like my inefficiency, you know, that makes you wonder, you know, like in realm of dharma, you know, I should be more willing to learn, you know, the language, and probably, you know, I'm very lazy, you know, I really don't read, you know, anything. I think, you know, from the feeling I can make it, but I see like, you know, this problem with many people because, you know, so probably, you know, I will notice your question and try to, you know, contact more like historical, you know, like events, historical language. You know, I will try. I'm very lazy. Sorry. But still, you know, you really are provoking me like little bit, you know, like really to learn, you know. I think it's really good question, like really good kind of point, you know. So certainly, you know, I feel sorry, as well as I will try, you know, next time, probably. Yes, sir.
I was wondering, because I only know one language, which is English.
Mm-hmm.
I'm far lazier than you, because I don't know any other language
whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. The thought did arise once or twice, because English for you is a second language.
Yeah.
You know, Hindi is your
first language. Yeah.
That it might be interesting at some point if it was if you spoke in Hindi with simultaneous English translation.
Mm-hmm.
I just wondered what your response.
Yeah, you know,
so that would be.
Yeah, maybe, you know, that is better.
Might be interesting.
Yeah, it could be interesting. But also, I think, you know, I don't know in also Hindi words, you know, like
I
haven't
Hindi
read
words.
You know much dharma book. You know.
No,
I know only like, you know, the feeling of dharma, you know, like
yes.
the inner part of dharma.
No,
and outer part, you know, I haven't learned. You know, I haven't like read many books. Like it's only when I have to translate, you know,
yes.
like I go with book and. That time only I did,
yes.
And then it's again book is kind of closed, and so I think laziness, you know.
I wasn't so much thinking here of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
What I actually had in mind here
mm-hmm.
was the construction with the grammar,
uh-huh.
with whether in the Hindi that would be just a question, an open question, whether that would be easier.
Yeah, that will be easier.
Because I think what Dave is saying, others will may have a feeling as well about. It's more on the grammar construction and the syntax, which is much 100 times easier for someone like me than it would be for you. I marvel at people who can give Dharma talks in the second language, as a number of the teachers here, like yourself, do. So laziness might be one factor in all of this.
I think it's most of it is the laziness.
That's it, all right. I didn't answer. one of the blessings with the Dharma teachings as a body of knowledge to contribute to the insight of the listener, that since it's not a set of beliefs, it's not a package, hopefully there's no clinging to any specific concepts. So the outcome of that is hopefully in the listening, in this case with somebody such as myself, a language of the Westerner, the home language of the English makes it easier. So hopefully out of that listening for the listener, some jewel will land, which is not in my hands nor in your hands, but sometimes something is said which makes things clearer, opens up something. Ah, yes. And similarly, even when we are listening, and I know this from my 10 years in the East, and listening to Tibetan teachers, and Hindi teachers, and Thai teachers, and Burmese teachers, and Sri Lankan teachers, whom English was their second language, or with translator, and sometimes the translator was hopeless, and that was putting it very nicely, that nevertheless some precious point or points can still register well. And I don't think we have to make a dual out of it. So what is important is that we listen clearly there. When we're in contact with teachers, whether English is the first or second language, whether it's clearly comprehensible or whether it's incomprehensible, nevertheless, out of it, either with the language, or with the tone, or with the flavor, or with the attitude, or with the spirit, many ways that a teaching can come across to us. And I do feel it's valuable and important for all of us to have that kind of receptivity. And of course, if the sense and feeling is strong towards a teacher or teachers, in terms of the connection, genuinely to listen to that voice as well. But sometimes, like here, because we have a range of teachers, AJ this afternoon, Christopher tomorrow, and Jaya and Radha will be giving talks. When we're in the situation of a range of teachers, always the good practice of total attention. And out of it, some small point just... So today, for example, when AJ was speaking about Manitloka, Dharmaloka, and Manitloka, I would translate really as mind in the world. Loka means world, the mind in the world. And this is a constant preoccupation with us, our mind, state of our mind in the world. And we can view life just through that viewpoint consistently. And there's Dharma Loka, which is the Dharma in the world and our relationship to that. And of course we can move between the two quite a lot. And that really is part of the exploration of Dharma in the world, mind in the world, heart, mind. The fullness of listening. Both can be a great value. Yes, anyone? Thanks, David. Good question. Yes. Yes, Hal, yes.
Question for both of you.
Yeah.
I've been thinking a lot about the period when the Buddha was alive and the Buddha taught, and all of the rules and regulations about being a monk and a nun, sit down, and all of the teachings and the shoulds and should nots of Buddhism in the context of other religions like Catholicism. Question refers to the historical context of when those rules, regulations, ideas were formulated, and bringing those forward to today.
Yeah.
Are there any of those rules and regulations that each of you think should be altered or changed to adapt to the modern world? And one of my particular things that I think should be change, not in the Buddhist context, but in Catholicism, is the problem with birth control.
Yeah.
You know, there's too many people in the world right now, and you know, when birth control is
absolutely
a serious problem. So if there are any, my question is, are there any issues in the Buddhist teaching, in rules and regulations, in the monastic?
Yeah, good point.
Should be altered.
Yeah. Any responses?
Really? Like good. If you can speak.
Sure. this question, I think if you heard the question in terms of, in this case, a 2,500-year-old of tradition, lots of rules and vows and precepts have been introduced from the early days right through to the present. And some of that, I would say, really needs to be questioned there. And it's interesting how the tradition and the original spirit, and this is the view that I have here, sometimes have departed from each other. The Buddha, as an example, was very critical of religious traditions in India, where so much of the intention was to preserve the rules, that so much effort went in to keeping rules. And he said, particularly with the Jains, who had many rules, this is, use strong language, useless effort, useless striving. So there's a very critical voice about just blindly upholding rules for the sake of upholding them. And he said it would be far better that our effort and our intention were put in not into trying to uphold rules, but to look at what's unhealthy and unwholesome inside of ourselves and the transformation of it. Yeah. And somehow that questioning of religion and rules, the example with Catholicism, of course, the obvious examples in Judaism, in Buddhism, in Islam, rules and rules, that the rules get established, very fixed. In the monk's life, which in the tradition, Theravada tradition, has 227 of these rules which are being preserved, and yet the dynamics of change, sociologically speaking, today means that if the Vinaya was, that means the discipline, was an alive tradition, there'd be a whole new set of rules. Monks wouldn't have televisions in their room, wouldn't have mobile phones, camcorders, cameras, and what's all the other junk they carry around with them, and numerous other things, which really, in a tradition of renunciation, that would be part of the renunciation, but because it's not in the rules, therefore there's license to carry all this stuff around, and therefore there's very little renunciation actually left. And what there is clinging to old rules. And I think this is a contemporary tragedy. And there is nobody, not the Dalai Lama, not the Sangharaja of Thailand, not the chief monk of Burma or in Sri Lanka or any Buddhist organization, which is willing to examine this dinosaur of old, out-of-date rules. It's a great pity. And therefore, as long as it goes, they'll be clinging to the old, but no real change will go on. This is a tragic, contemporary tragedy. And the second, amongst them, I can go on for a few hours, but I'm trying to keep the discipline. The second is that women and men of contemporary generations have found a lot of freedoms which were simply not available 2,500 years ago. And any serious reading and reflection on the time of the Buddha, one realized the rigidity of caste, the rigidity of role, that every son was expected to follow in the footsteps of the father. That was the rule that was laid down by the Brahmins and laid down in the Vedas. And what also went along with it was the subservience of women to the male authority. And even today in India, you will still see, what should we say, if we put it nicely, 90% of men on the streets and 10% of the women. Because women do not have access to social outgoing life in the way that men do. Just sit in any chai shop, except for the pilgrims that come with their families, especially today on a Sunday. But women and men have worked very, very hard for their freedoms in our networks, in our societies. There's still, of course, a long way to go. But what that really does mean, I think, for us, that the structure of householders and monks and nuns, which has a beneficial place in society, and I have great support from men and women who become monks and nuns, but we can have another type of nomadic life with relationship or without relationship, living with much simplicity and austerity as we are doing here for short or long periods of time there, and really keeping some free spirit and homelessness alive. Many monks have no idea of homelessness because most monks live in a monastery, and the monastery is their home. They might be living with 100 people, like I was, who one would never choose to live with, but nevertheless, some of means you here, are keeping the spirit alive of homelessness, really alive, and all credit to you for doing it there. So I do think there's a lot of re-evaluation has to be made with regard to past and present. Less problems around celibacy, sexuality, that's a traditional view, the re-examination of these old rules in light of the contemporary situation. These two would immediately stand out for me in the Buddhist world. Yes, sorry if I rambled on a bit. But anyway,
like you said it all, and I think, I'm just behind you.
All right.
Kind of like, really, I think any rule, is bad for in a time and for a certain kind of like situation. And because, time and situation keeps on changing.
Exactly.
So every time, we really have to look and see if this is relevant or not.
Exactly.
And keep on changing, this is how probably, humanity can run if we keep on changing. Otherwise, there is no way. So I think we should look forward, to change what needs to be changed.
The great problem with religion is of the many institutions around, it is one of the slowest to make change.
Yeah.
It resists change. And it's been a constant problem with religion. And it's up to us to see what's useful and beneficial and what religion in its best sense keeps alive and present for us. but also have the freedom to see what the albatross is in religion and get it off our backs. Yes, anyone please. Yes, sir.
It's for a question for both of you.
Yes, please. Yes.
To
your names?
Chris.
Chris, yep.
Your comments on the role of sexuality, sexual energy in modern spirituality, especially in the context of what we've just been talking about in terms of old rules and monastic traditions, in terms of freedom and non-freedom.
Mm. Yes. The role of sexuality and the role in freedom and non-freedom. Is that
awakening
right?
An awakening.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, actually, sexuality, you know, it's like very natural, you know, like we are born with this sexuality. So, I think, like, to avoid, you know, is really difficult. As far as I know, maybe some people can do, but like as far as I know, it's really difficult to avoid. So it has to be, this has to be seen, you know, that like, you know, this is not a problem, you know. This is, I am born with, and I really have to take care of it, you know, like it's not a problem that I can put it off. It cannot be put off. So somehow ways has to be find that how to deal, you know, how to deal wisely. And, you know, then probably dealing it wisely, you know, then this will not be a problem. Like problem is because we are not dealing it wisely. So that's why it seems problem. So really kind of dealing, you know, wisely. And feeling, using the feeling, and right circumstances, you know, so many things. And probably then you will not see this, that this is a problem.
Yeah. Right. And I agree wholeheartedly here of the AJ of the importance to really include and embrace sexuality as part of human beings, as part of human nature. And coming back to the point I said a few minutes ago, that it seems to me religion has not coped very well with sexuality. And when we can't cope with something, we tend to exclude, we tend to reject, if not repress. And when that happens, what religion has done traditionally is to make a virtue out of celibacy. So when something isn't handled very well, not understood very well, it makes a virtue out of celibacy. And as a small example of what I'm referring to here, during the month of December, two important religious figures made public statements. One was the Dalai Lama, and the other was the Pope. And the Dalai Lama, in a press conference in Central America, I can't remember the precise wording, forgive me, but said essentially that there were a lot of problems associated with sex. And it could lead to a lot of problems, and he said, even murder, something like that, problems with sex. And though the celibate is missing out on something, he said something like celibacy would be better or easier. And the Pope criticized those women and men who are looking into social gender issues. And again, I can't remember the precision of the words that he said, but the Pope said something along the lines that God had made men and women with a particular purpose and function, and therefore the implication being that love and sexuality of the same gender should not be happening, and views like this. Yeah. So I have a blog. And once a week I write my blog, or so, except when I'm away. And my comment on the two, because I had the precise quotes, was one, two elderly men who have no experience of sexuality whatsoever in their entire lives are probably not the best authorities on a sexual life. Period. And the second comment I made is that both men should remember that they both wear skirts. And I have the authority to write that because I had the privilege of wearing a skirt myself for 6 years. Any questions, please? Yes.
It's about abortion.
Abortion.
Yes. Mm-hmm. For both of you.
Mm-hmm. So the question is on abortion and how ethically we can accept it or our view on it, is that?
Yes, you can give like a point of view, since everything is a point of view, you can give your point of view.
Yeah, yeah.
About how it's being used or abused.
Yeah. Do you want to respond? Yeah.
So maybe like you are saying, like when it is used for abuse. Is this your question?
In your opinion, how far is it being used or abused?
No, I think because we need like this control of like people, you know, there are many, many people. So it can be like a useful way to use also. And also there are like misuses of it, you know, like in India, especially, if you find out is a girl, you know, then you go for it. So, you know, I will feel bad about that, you know, not really. So many, many, many things, you know, which are useful in it, and also many, many not useful. So, you know, I have both views, you know, useful and useless.
This is one of the many areas which I regard as a very deep and very sensitive issue. And I speak as a man, but also speak from the understanding there, and just to add as well, in my family, my daughter's a midwife. So we have many, many conversations, and over the years I've talked with many women, over the past 35 years, who are struggling around the issue of being pregnant and not knowing whether or not to continue in the pregnancy there. And the view that I take with this is I think it's a contemporary tragedy that any individual, that is a woman especially, or the man who is the father, should feel in such a situation of isolation, should feel under such pressure to abort. And I don't think that is the act of the individual, but I think it's emerging from a society which has great difficulty in understanding the very characteristic of a really supportive nature of love and what the power of love actually is and what the power of life is. And it's the forces of individualism, which I feel are rotten and corrupt all the way through, places the huge burden on the individual, that is, the pregnant woman, no matter what her age, to make some decision by herself. And if we had a genuinely loving and caring and supportive community of people who were fully supportive of the process of life, women would not be under this kind of pressure. And I would say all of us have to take the fullest responsibility for every abortion. Yes.
I was interested in your feeling about dying and what importance you give to this moment, and if you have any
feeling of dying. My dying.
If we will all die, like, what is your personal feeling about your own death? And if you in any way, like, prepare for it, or how much it comes into your practice, if there is practice, like, something about you would say something.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I think, you know, my feeling is I'm looking forward, you know, to looking forward to, you know, to have it. And kind of like, you know, probably this looking forward, you know, it comes because, like, somehow, like, having known the death, like, having really known the death, then he's really looking forward, kind of, you know, to that. And if I haven't known, maybe this looking forward, but with little fear, you know, like not really looking forward. So this is my relation with death. Yeah.
Question for both of us.
Yes.
Repeat the question.
About dying, what's your personal feeling about your own death?
Mm-hmm.
How much importance you give to this moment, to what's happening, and if you in any way prepare for it, or
good,
if there's
good
any
question.
Practice.
We kind of go from the beginning of life, now we go down the other end to the end of it. Bottom line, bottom line. I don't believe there's any such thing as dying or death. I just don't believe in it. It's not something which I feel I have to prepare for. And hopefully the understanding of that, no guarantee, will stay steady, that the event, this and the white hair coming, and all that's underneath it, is such that it's not me. Period. So, why prepare? Why think it's me? Therefore, aging, dying, and death. It's a non-truth. Yes. Anyone, please. Yes, sir.
This is a bit long for you, but actually we've got something up this morning. You were talking about form and formlessness.
That's right.
Meditation.
Yeah.
And the ability of a good meditator to balance between the two.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you say a bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So we had a group this morning on meditation, on deep meditation. And what's your name?
Micah.
Huh?
Micah.
Micah. Okay. Reflecting back there, some responses I had around form and formless meditation. And what I had in mind when I was speaking, and I'll just add a little bit to that, there's the great value of using the form. And the form can be in the form of the posture, the upright, slow, mindful, conscious walking, the standing, the reclining posture. They're forms. And then there's the forms which might accompany that, called method and technique, mindfulness of breathing, awareness of the body, deep absorptions, expanding the consciousness, opening the heart meditations, etc. The application of forms for the welfare of the human being. All of that is precious and valuable. Sometimes there is the value and great importance of simply letting go of the form. And the letting go of the form may include the methods and techniques which help to develop our life, shall we say, or develop consciousness, to let go of those. And sometimes there is also letting go of the form called formal sitting, formal walking meditation, formal standing, formal reclining, to let those go as well. And there can be a real receptivity of that which has no form. Sometimes, even in the form, i.e. cross-legged, sitting, walking, etc., we sometimes are giving far too much time in the form to working on ourselves. And I sometimes protest about this. And therefore, sometimes with just the form, we really need to let go of this idea of me constantly working on myself in meditation. And if I can just sometimes just let go of that and not be concerned about myself, it might open up the opportunity for meditation which has got nothing to do with working on myself. And therefore there's some receptivity to some ultimacies which is not about myself. And that I would call the receptivity to something formless, which may be with the simple form of formal meditation, or it may just be totally without any formal meditation posture. I'm not working on myself, I'm not interested in my finiteness, and there is an openness or a receptivity to something different. And that's the beauty of formlessness. And to have the freedom, so that we don't identify with the formlessness to a degree which sometimes happens, that we start undermining and dismissing formal meditation practice. This is a foolish person who does this. They'll end up as a prisoner to the formlessness. And it would be a pity if a person identifies and attaches themselves to the form, method and technique, and purification and working on oneself, and completely miss the point that we need to let that be lower in our attention in order for a receptivity which is not of form, and not of method, not of purification, not of working on ourselves. Therefore the Buddha speaks, precise words are, liberation both ways. Freedom to explore form at any point, freedom to drop it at any point. Freedom to take one up again at any point, freedom to drop it again at any point. So freedom with form and freedom with formlessness. Have I responded enough, or you want to ask another? from the perspective of Dharma, there is neither who near was nor was. From the perspective of Dharma, there is this process which is unfolding itself. Period. And if we were to make a claim over who's doing it, be watchful of the claimant. That's all. So, rather than getting caught in an eye, there's this process which is going on. And that is perhaps the wise response.
Is that awareness neutral? Somewhere between the form and the form?
Is the awareness
neutral?
Mm-hmm. I wish it was. I'm muttering away over here, don't worry. There is... Am I taking up too much time on this one? good point, a good question. The awareness has neither neutrality nor non-neutrality to it. The nature of the awareness is it reveals. And therefore it reveals the form. I sit in meditation, the awareness reveals the form. Form can't reveal itself, it's just form. The awareness reveals the formless. And that awareness is affected by forms and formlessness, methods and techniques, and all the events that go along with it. When we're not so much in the grip of either, then the element of awareness which is revealing takes on an unusual interest. It's not neutral, and it's not non-neutral. Yes, anyone, please. Yes?
Maybe piggybacking on that a little bit.
Yeah.
If you go to Burma.
Yes.
They say, this is the way.
This is the way.
This is the path.
Mm-hmm.
It has a form and it has a formless.
Yes.
If you go to Tibet, they say, this is the way.
Yes.
This is the path. It has a formless and has a formless inside of it. If you go to the West,
yes. Gourmet ghettos.
And the spirituality seems to be doing this also. So it feeds the deletion.
Mm.
If you have a great understanding of the formless and the form, I think what you're saying is those pieces could all be put together into realization.
Yes. Yeah.
Spiritualities all dropping in at the same time, whether it's the Vedas and the Yogas and the Dharma from here and the Dharma from there and the spirituality of this, and we're doing one thing in the morning and one thing in the afternoon and one thing and we're listening to the Tibetan guy and the Burmese guy and the Thai guy. And
Damon is from California, she just put the context. Yeah. Right.
What could the outcome of this be? I mean, you listen to the Dalai Lama, he says, try them all out and then pick one. Do you agree with that? Or do you agree with what's happening in Northern California? I mean, I don't know how to ask a question.
No, it's a good point. I do agree, David.
So, you know, I think really I have to see far beyond, you know, like, you know, it's not like many things are happening, like, you know, like as you said, like many, many options are there. But if I go for all of them, probably, you know, I will be mad, you know, I have to go to a hospital, like if I really go for all of them. So somewhere I have to be smart enough to look for me, you know, what will work for me. And hopefully, you know, all of them will work for somebody, you know, not all of them at the same time for one person. Probably amongst all of them, one of them will be for me. So I will really choose that and go with that and not care, you know, about like, you know, so many things are going on. And probably so many things are going on because they have some value, you know, to somebody. Not for me, maybe to someone else. So I will see in that way.
The two responses I have, because it's an important area here at Daimonship, as you pointed out, and there are some places from my travels have a more concentration of this proliferation of spiritual thoughts, shall we say, like where you live. But in other parts of the West, it's actually not like that at all. And that may have other deficits elsewhere. But in fact, more importantly, it's not around the similarities and the dissimilarities. It's not about what the Dalai Lama says or what Christopher says. It's not about all the profusion of thoughts, practices, methods and techniques, therapies, mind, body, East, West, Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism, etc., etc. If a human being is totally one-pointedly dedicated to truth, that is the unwavering focus, and is not interested in this proliferation of ideas, this supermarket of stuff which people like me and others contribute to, and has thoroughly rejected the this oneness view, which is a current fad, and there's not a scrap of truth in it, there, and we just keep single-pointed focus on what is truth, and really dedicated to that with unwavering interest, truth will come through. And all the relativity of all these differences and sameness and differences and all that the books that we write and the articles and the chai shop conversations comparing this and that, we say, God, it's just so much shit in the mind. That's all it is. Truth and the power of it and the authenticity of it will come through. It will come through. But don't get lost in the proliferation. Yes, a couple more questions and end of the day.
What is true?
It's called passing the buck, isn't it?
Something which you feel inside you, which is not an idea and feeling and emotion, you know, like, so I don't know how to speak in language. I will say that is truth, like, which is not your idea, your feeling, your emotion. In spite of this, you know, some very, very alive, you know, aliveness. later, when it comes to kind of like what I was describing, manas realm, you know, when it contacts there, then you say, ah, it's a life feeling. Before this, even this is not known. So, you know, truth is that, like, inside you.
In the response to what is truth, it is the most wonderful, profound, and most precious element that when it enters into our life, the potency of it interrupts radically and fundamentally the problems of the past that have influenced the present. It contributes to and is the force that wakes us up. Nothing else will do it. And the sense and the taste of it, it is both authentically liberating and it releases love into life. So when truth has entered into life, and it's not a given that goes with life, it's not to be found in the here and now, it's not the here and now, but when it enters into life, it transforms it, it wakes us up, it's liberating, and it allows love to enter freely into the field of existence. This is what truth is. This is why it's so precious for a human being to be totally committed to it. Enough for today? Unless there's any last single burning question anywhere, feel free to ask. Have a quiet minute or two. Oh, right, have a quiet minute or two. Oh yes, sir, go on. Seen as leading to
expansion.
So we need some clarification. Okay. Any verification on passion? What does it lead to? Response here.
Okay. Person kind of like alone or person far something, you know. Like person. Person can be felt as person, as well as person far. So if you are talking about only person or person far?
Both.
Okay. So of course, like person far will lead to whatever far is. And person alone with will kind of like explore you, you know, like somehow exploration, expanding quality will happen and, you know, expansion. So, like, this is what person will do.
It's like, for me, I just don't get it why in the Dharma they say it's leading to suffering.
Person is leading to suffering. But, you know, I don't think so that anybody says that passion is leading to suffering. Maybe they say passion far is leading to suffering.
Okay. I'll quote the Buddha. He's not a bad authority. He speaks of Dharma Raga and Kama Raga. Kama, K-A-M-A, not K-A-R-M-A, is the passion to have, the passion to own. He says this is riddled with problems. Sometimes in our life, human beings' life, people are just obsessed, have a passion for something. And a passion can be so strong, it's exclusive of much else. The musician can have a great passion for his or her art, and nothing appears to be wrong with that, but the cost is alienation from their loved ones, disconnection from their children, and a lot of a big mess of a life all the way around, and tremendous identification with success, born out of that passion. This is called Kama Raga. Some people have a passion for making money. They think that's the best thing they can do with their life. Always, even in their 60s and 70s, you see them, these desperate human beings in the stock market. All they can do is think about adding more numbers to the current set. And recently, of course, had a wonderful kick up the arse. Extremely grateful. Maybe some learning will come out of it. Not much chance, but... You know. And then there's Dharma Raga, passion for Dharma, passion for truth, passion for life, passion for compassion, passion for love, passion for service. And I notice, if I may say, in the 35, whatever it is, years of teaching, though, because I love the Dharma, so much of the passion for the Dharma itself, that as someone commented this morning in our, I had a meeting with those who are living along the row. I sometimes call it death row over there, you see, because I'm hoping desperately for the death of the ego with everyone who's along the row, so it's death row. And so this morning from 9 to 9:45, 20 of us in the row, sitting in a circle together there. And two or three people commented afterwards on my, what was it, boyishness or youthfulness or passion or enthusiasm or whatever, there. And it's quite lovely with the passion. That even though we might, you know, how many times have I listened to people's accounts of their mind is wandering, you know, or that they've got a knee pain, or they're planning too much in the future. I mean, can you imagine how many, I mean, how many times? And if I started to think about it, I'd, whatever, probably... curl up and put the mattress over my head. But the passion, actually, in its lovely, lovely way, keeps it rather fresh. That the enthusiasm and the love of the Dharma and the love of the practice and the love of sharing and especially love of people, liking people, enjoying people, that it keeps it kind of fresh, one's enthusiasm. And I think that's a reflection of what passion is all about. It feels new and fresh, even though, you know, repeat ourselves and people in the same or different forms, and sometimes people will come and they'll tell me some story. And I'll say to the person, you told me exactly the same a year ago. And you're still going on about it. Etc. And there's been no letting go. Just holding on to the stories as we tend to do. So passion is a passion for change as well. Passion for waking up. A passion to take risks with life. We need passion. You know, there are a few dead Buddhists wandering around. They usually call it equanimity. let's have a quiet minute together, shall we?